Hey folks, Sam Jones here. I think you're really going to love this episode with Jenna Fisher. But before we get started, I just wanted to try a little something new. Something a little more personal. If you haven't figured it out by now, I'm a guy with a lot of interests. And my whole life, I have had multiple hobbies, obsessions, passions, and a never-ending quest for new experiences. I also appreciate the little things in life, like a great book, or the perfect pen for drawing cartoons, or a great pair of skate shoes, or the perfect neighborhood fish taco. So in the spirit of that, I thought I would add a little semi-regular feature to the podcast that highlights the things I love. Each episode, I will try to tell you about something that has enhanced my life in some small way that I can pass along to you. These aren't advertisements or sponsored items. They're just things I think you might enjoy knowing about. And maybe, through sharing these things, you'll learn a little more about me as well. So, if that interests you, listen on. This week, to kick things off, I will share two things that actually go quite well together. I have always loved learning about the history of rock and roll through the eyes and ears of its more colorful journalists. And I've enjoyed the writings of folks like Lester Bangs and Cameron Crowe. Recently, I was turned on to a book called Can't Stand Up for Falling Down by former Melody Maker journalist Alan Jones, who was a spectacular drunk, had a shrewd and caustic eye for bullshit, and happened to start his career the same time as punk rock and new wave exploded in England. His hilarious and shocking accounts of his encounters with everyone from Joe Strummer, Ozzy Osbourne, Chrissy Hynde, and Lou Reed reveal these artists in a less than flattering way, and really made me see that period of music in a whole new light. This is the opposite of hagiography, and Jones makes no attempt to whitewash these iconic figures' often pompous and infantile behavior. I'm looking at Elvis Costello, Sting, and Lou Reed in a whole new light. It's a great artifact of a time in music that not only reveals the differences in journalism between the States and the UK, but it also shines a light on what a male-dominated, boorish environment the music industry was, and maybe still is. It's definitely a great read, and you should check it out. And for my second little item of joy, and a great companion to this book, I'm going to talk about beef jerky. I apologize to all the vegetarians out there, and I'm trying to eat less meat, but I've always had a soft spot for the hard, dry stuff. And my wife recently found some jerky in New Mexico that I just love. It's made by the Casablanca Beef Jerky Company, and it's unlike any jerky I've ever tasted. It's hard, thin, and dry, and yet, once you start chomping on it, it becomes tender and flavorful. Of course, being from New Mexico, they have a red chili version, a green chili version, which is my favorite, and a few others. And like I said, they're not a sponsor of the show. I just wanted to tell you about it. If you like beef jerky, run, don't walk to their website, CasablancaBeefJerky.com, and order up some of that green chili jerky. Again, sorry to all the vegetarians, but this stuff is so good that you might just want to try it anyway. I'll never tell. So there you go. A few recommendations for your week. Let me know if you like this feature, and especially let me know if you read Alan Jones's book, Can't Stand Up for Falling Down, or if you try the Casablanca Beef Jerky. We can geek out about it. Okay, now on with the show. Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And this time I sit down with actress and author Jenna Fisher. As Pam Beasley on The Office, Jenna worked her way into the homes and hearts of Americans for 9 seasons. As herself, Jenna charmed her way into the hearts and minds of the entire staff here at Off Camera with her endearing humility and self-deprecating nature. Born and bred in St. Louis, Missouri, Jenna grew up far away from Hollywood or New York City. But from the moment she took the stage as Toto, the dog, in The Wizard of Oz, she knew she wanted to be an actor, albeit playing human parts. There was only one problem. She had no idea how to engineer an acting career. Sure, you can go to acting school and learn how to act, but nobody tells you how to get an agent, how to deal with rejection, what it's like to bomb in an audition, or how to navigate Screen Actors Guild vouchers. Undaunted, she packed up her hatchback with all her worldly possessions, including her cat, and moved to a seedy section of West Hollywood to pursue her dream. With a little delusion, reinforced by some magical thinking by her mother, who would say, "If Oprah did it, so can you," and with a lot of perseverance, Jenna established herself as a working actor. But it certainly didn't happen overnight. She struggled for 8 long years as a starving artist before she got her big break as Pam Beasley on The Office. And although she had a 9-season run on arguably one of television's all-time most popular shows, Jenna still didn't take her career for granted, believing you're always one horrible performance away from not getting the next job. So what did Jenna do next? She wrote the book that she so desperately needed in her formative years, entitled The Actor's Life, A Survival Guide. And it's like no book about acting that has preceded it. It's filled with advice about the most important minutiae that actors need to survive. But more importantly, it's a handbook for survival, a testament to perseverance, and a hilarious accounting of her early years hustling jobs in Hollywood. And as an added bonus, it even teaches aspiring thespians how to deal with getting fired, which is exactly what happened to Jenna while she was writing the book. Jenna joins me to talk about that experience, and also about her undeniable chemistry with John Krasinski, sneaking into an SNL party to meet Molly Shannon, and why she never visited her neighborhood movie theater. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Jenna.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, as we were talking about before we started rolling the cameras, I met you briefly around season 3 of The Office.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny how time has just flown by, because I still think of The Office as sort of, it was just on.
Yeah.
You know, but it's been, what, 12, 15 years since you started that show?
It's almost 15 years since we started it.
It's such an amazing thing. I think especially when you're on a television show that recurs weekly over that many seasons.
Yeah.
How you become sort of ingrained in people's minds as that person. And yet, you know, since that show, you've gone on to do so many things. You've done a show on Sky, You, Me, and the Apocalypse. Done several films. You did Brad Status, which I loved.
It's so good.
So good. And now you've got a show coming out on ABC.
Yes.
Called Splitting Up Together.
Yes.
With Oliver Hudson. You did a Clint Eastwood film, and you wrote this book, which
yeah.
I wanted to start with the book, because I feel like I'm not an actor. I don't have aspirations to be an actor. And I read your book thinking, okay, maybe this is just going to be a book about how to be an actor. But most acting books are about finding the character or understanding the motivation or discovering a method or a process that leads you to, you know, embodying a narrative. And your book seems to literally, it's like a nuts and bolts approach to acting plus this amazing autobiography. And I was just floored by your book.
Thank you. The original inspiration for the book was that I wanted to write a resource that I wish I'd had when I started.
So you were writing it almost to your younger self.
I was. I was writing it to the girl back in Missouri who was going to get in a car and drive to LA and did not know what she was driving into.
Right.
Because it's true what you were saying, which is that, like, it's not a book about how to find a character or how to say your lines a certain way, because they teach you all of that in acting school.
Or
even an acting class. Like, that you can go learn. But nobody tells you what to do when you leave an agent meeting feeling like you bombed and then you're at home crying and, by the way, you're out of milk because you can't afford milk. Like, no one tells you how to deal with that situation.
Right.
It was all of that.
Why not?
I don't know. Like, the perseverance question is, like, that's the thing. No one teaches you that in school. They also, frankly, don't teach you how to get an agent. So
right.
I was like, these are definitely 2 chapters in the book. But yeah. All of it. And just the difference between, like, especially for me, like, you know, the expectation of how it worked versus how it really works, you know. And
right.
The people at home who think they're being encouraging, you know, but they're really just, like, not helping, you know, like my sweet mom, or my well-meaning mom, who will be like, Jenna, I saw a commercial the other day for Neutrogena, and you have fantastic skin. You need to call your commercial agent and say you want to do one of those. Like, oh, yes, why haven't I been calling Neutrogena, Mom? Of course, you know, I'm not SAG, and I, you know, like, as if this agent is going to even take my call.
Right, or that there's a phone number of who to
call. For Neutrogena, or
right.
for the ad company, or
right.
whoever, if they just saw your skin. But, you know, it's like that idea where, like, oh, the reason you're not in a Neutrogena commercial is because you hadn't thought of it.
That's right.
Or and that happens to writers too. Yeah, exactly. But it happens to writers too, which is like, you know, someone's a funny writer and like, you need to write for SNL.
Yeah.
That's what you need to do. You just need to go write for them.
I have the answer for you.
Just get that interview with them. But the heart of the book is that message that like, just because you see something, you see someone who is successful at something doesn't mean it's because it came easily to them.
Right.
Like, so if you're on a journey and it's difficult, it doesn't mean you're going to fail. And it doesn't mean you should stop being on that journey. That it's going to be a series of like seemingly insurmountable hurdles. And that's a common thread among artists. And we've all thought we're going to quit. I mean, even now I think I might quit. Like I'm always quitting. I'm almost always quitting, you know, because something is exasperating or difficult or feels too vulnerable or too scary. And that's the other thing is just the idea that there's some finish line. Like once I hit this level of success, I'm not going to want to quit anymore, or it's not going to hurt anymore, or it's not going to bruise me in some way anymore.
I would think that having to relook at your career to be able to write this book, it would probably bring up a lot of stuff. Like what did having to look at your whole life like that reveal to you that maybe you weren't even aware of before you started the process?
I didn't realize how sort of crazy and delusional I was early on.
Really?
Like just some of the things that, like crashing a party in order to meet someone that I admired, or crashing an audition because I thought that I would be good for the role. Like that sort of, I don't know, now that I'm older or something, like there was some sort of like youthful deliriousness or something, youthful delusion that I had. And I'm sort of very surprised by that because I didn't think of myself as a particularly like egotistical person. Like it wasn't like, I deserve this. I'm so great. It was like more of, I don't know. Like, I was just like, well, what do I have to lose? They're not calling me in anyway. Might as well crash the audition and see what happens. I could never imagine doing those things. Like, when I was recalling all of this sort of like, I think it was just out of desperation.
But I think that that's an important thing that artists share is there does have to be some delusion or some sort of expectation that the world's going to work out, even though all of the statistical odds are stacked so far against you.
Yes. A lot of times people think that people become actors because they want to be, they show off. They want to be seen, they want to be applauded. But more often than not, the artists I meet, and this is true for me, like we're more hermity, we're shy, uncomfortable with maybe a lot of praise, embarrassed by being recognized, but very much in love with creating characters and performing. But all the other stuff isn't why we became actors.
Right.
So I think you need a little bit of it when you're trying to make it. Like, I think you need a little bit of that bravado, which I think is a little bit what we're talking about in terms of that delusion, the like, I am good enough. And so I tell this story about that I had this awakening with my husband a couple of years ago. I sort of naturally slouch. I have very bad posture. I'm trying to sit up straight for this interview. But I slouch, and I sort of walk through the world a little bit like I'm apologizing for being there. And when I got the role of Pam, I did not have to work on that aspect of me.
You got to put that right
into Pam. So when The Office was over, I got this job on Sky in London, playing this character who started out that way, but by the end of the series was shooting a gun and carjacking things and like was like an action star. And I was like, well, that person can't walk around like she's apologizing for being there. So how am I going to do this? Because I can't play the character and the whole time just be like shoulders back, shoulders back, shoulders back, shoulders back. Like I can't like perform and mutter shoulders back. So I enrolled in a body movement class called Feldenkrais, and it was great. And I started walking naturally with posture. And my husband asked me, he was like, how's it feel? How's it feel to walk with proper posture? And I was like, I feel braggy. I feel like I'm like boastful, like I'm like, look at me, I'm here. And he said to me, it was amazing. He said, you know, you shouldn't have to apologize for the amount of space that your body naturally takes up in the world.
Right.
He goes, you're just standing there straight. He goes, you realize that you're not going, you're not like walking around like you're all that. And I'm like, it's true. Simply being in posture made me feel like I was, people were going to be like, who does she think she is?
But isn't that funny how,
isn't that interesting?
How just from here to here,
I was,
makes you feel like you were giving a different message out to
yes,
the world
and I
that
was,
maybe you didn't deserve it.
And I was, yes. And so I like to tell young artists, like, similarly, you don't need to apologize for the amount of space that your artistry takes up in the world. Please give it, like, we need it. We want it. Like, you don't have to walk around, like, afraid of expressing your art.
Right.
Like, I think a lot of artists are sometimes like, I have an idea or I have a character, I want to try something, or I want to make something or I want to do something. But then there's the voice in your head that's like, it's probably not very good. I don't know, forget it. And then you just sort of like become this person again.
Right.
So that's the constant fight is like, I think saying that what I have to say is of value. People are going to like it. It's okay. That's most of, I think, an artist's battle is that internal thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. You meet some people who are very comfortable being great, but most people
don't
are not.
People piss you off.
Well, you know, like, what would life be like if I could have that? That'd be amazing.
Right. What were their parents doing right that my parents missed?
I know. I just, I had that Midwestern Catholic upbringing, you know, don't boast, you know.
Right.
Don't show off.
Take up too much space.
Don't take up too much space.
That's right.
Be a polite person.
And I think that it's funny that as an artist, that message can certainly be turned in your head into, you know, I'm not worthy of coming in a room and saying, I just had a great idea.
Yeah. It can be very confining to
right,
an artist.
Right.
So you do have to embrace this whole artistic life where you're a little weird, you're a little selfish, you're a little self-involved, you're in your head, you're
right.
thinking about yourself, your character, like, you know, it's okay. That's okay.
Well, you know what's fascinating about the book is you start out by saying straight up that you weren't the most talented person in your town, or you weren't the celebrated kid in the high school getting the leads in plays.
I was not.
You were in the, I mean, so I've certainly talked to enough actors that they were sort of the shining star of their ecosystem, whether it was their drama school or their high school, or they were being asked to audition for a Broadway show at age 10, or, you know.
Yeah.
But what I found fascinating is that not only were you not that person, and you were just in the chorus line of the musicals in your high school, and yet here you are in the middle of the country, not getting the lead roles in plays, and at one point I assume you go to your parents, you go, I'm going to be an actor and I'm going to move to Los Angeles.
Yeah. There's literally no indication from the outside
no.
world that this is going to work out. I was certainly like, it was all I talked about from about the time I was a freshman in high school. And I begged them to let me move to Los Angeles
what
after high school.
What were you basing that on?
Literally nothing. I don't know. It was just like all I ever wanted to do. And, you know, my mom is this very interesting person because she does have a type of magical thinking, which is like, well, I mean, if one person did it, then you can do it. She would say things like, well, you know, I read somewhere that Oprah said from a very young age she knew she was going to be very successful in this life. Maybe that's you. Do you know what I mean? So she'd
be
like,
so she contributed
well,
to your delusion.
A little bit,
yeah.
You know? So, but it was, you know, she was like, well, I don't know. She's saying it. So, but it wasn't like there was no talent scout sitting my mom down being like, you've got a real talent on your hands and we're going to need to invest in it.
Right.
You know, my mom always said she felt a calling to be a teacher. And that was very important to her because she felt like by following that calling, she was very happy in life.
Right.
So she would say, do you feel a calling to be an actor? And I'd be like, I guess that's what it is. It's a calling. Sure, I'd guess.
Now, what's you your know? Dad doing at this point? Is he like
my
half
dad,
reading the newspaper and
my
listening?
My dad is like, you can do whatever you want, but I'm not paying for it. You know, like there's, don't ask me for a loan, you know. And of course I asked for a million loans, you know, like boop, 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 dad, my car engine blew up. Can I borrow $800? And, but no, they were, I think it was very frightening for them when they visited me in LA in my first apartment. I, now that I'm a parent, I can't believe they left. I can't believe they left me there. Like, it was a pretty awful apartment. It was in a decent part of town, but it was the back of my apartment, my window to my bedroom, faced the back of the Pleasure Chest, which is like a famous sex store in West Hollywood on Santa Monica Boulevard. And across the street from that was like a gay porn theater. Back when, like, before the internet, when you actually had to go to a theater to see these sorts of movies, none of it bothered us. Like, we were like, none of this is bothering us. Like, there's nothing weird about the clientele. There's just, like, a ton of dildos over in that store. Like, just right there out my window. So, but the whole place was kind of scary and really run down. And all I had was what I could bring in my hatchback, you know, which was, like, a futon mattress, like, tied to the top of the car, and then, like, a few pots and pans that I'd had, like, in college, and then my cat and the clothes.
Yeah,
and,
your cat.
My cat, Andy, who licked out patches of his fur because he was, like, once we got to LA, he was like, this place is awful.
Even your cat was
My cat was like, what miserable. Have we done, woman? So, but no, and then, like, a couple months later, my parents flew out to visit me. So, and I'd been living there just giving reports. I mean, it's fantastic. It's great. I love it. I can't imagine what that was like when they came in, how they did not have an immediate, well, I'll tell you what they did. They drove me like almost an hour to outside of Pasadena to the only Walmart that they could find. And they bought me like $500 worth of like stuff. They're like, here's like stuff, you know, like your apartment is terrifying me.
Like, they bought you disinfectant.
They did, exactly. Just like, what else do you need? A trash can? Do you need a, you don't seem to have a trash can. How are you guys dealing with that?
They didn't have to buy you dildos, though.
The dildos were close by. Those were right over there.
I'm sorry.
No, I know. And my mom was like, oh, look, a little movie there. Do you ever go see films there?
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, Mom, I don't. Yeah. Why?
I take
and
the
I'm
cat.
Like, check it out.
We go to
check
the...
it out. So, yeah. So they had to, like, drive away, and I wish you could have them on the show and ask them, like, what were you thinking? Like, what were they thinking?
Yeah.
Were they just like, oh, my God, we just left our 21-year-old daughter.
Maybe they didn't really love you.
Maybe they didn't. Maybe they were like, good riddance.
Well,
but
that's the end of her.
They were like, wow. I mean, I can't imagine.
You know, I had the same crappy little apartment in the same neighborhood of Hollywood and... lived on a Murphy bed and did all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that...
And did it bother you at the time?
At the time, it didn't bother me at all.
Weird, right? Like, it was like, you were like, I'm living my dream. This is amazing.
Well, I'm curious about that, you know, because you talk so much about the struggle the first 6-8 years of being out in L.A. And you talk about not being able to get any commercial
Never booked
gigs.
A single commercial.
Never booked a single
I have still
commercial.
Not ever been on a commercial.
But I guess what I was curious about was... how you learn to deal with the voice in your head that maybe would creep up at the worst times, and I'm assuming you had this because I had it, of maybe I'm not supposed to be doing this. Like when you didn't get commercials or when you would go weeks without any sort of anything.
Yes.
Did you ever sort of worry that there were signs that you weren't supposed to be doing this?
Yes, but what was the alternative? Like, what was I going to do? Like, I couldn't think, like, what do I do then? Do I move home? Like, what's my job? Like, who am I? It was more fear of, like, if this doesn't work out, I'm going to have to live the life of someone else. Like, I'm going to have to get a conventional job and I live back in my hometown. And, like, that doesn't, I don't think that's me. Like, I think I'm an actor. Like, that's what I feel like I am. And so... it would be so weird to, like, live this whole other version of me that didn't feel authentic.
God, that's amazing to me that you, even in the face of when things weren't working out, that it still seem so much like that was supposed to be your life.
Well, I had a big realization about 2 years in, and I didn't put this in the book, but so when I moved here, I was dating someone, and right before we moved here, he put a ring on the finger, right? Like, we're gonna...
Oh, really?
Yeah, so engaged. But I put it in quotes because we were very young, and I'm not really feeling like we knew what we were doing. But anyway, it was more of a symbol of like, you know, even though you're moving, we're committed. And he was still back in school in St. Louis. He had some time to finish up a graduate degree. And his dream was to move back home to his hometown of Detroit and start a business there with his degree. And so what we agreed to before I left was like, okay, we're in love, we love each other, but I have to go do this. And in 2 years, when you graduate, if I haven't made it, I'll move to your hometown with you, you can start your business, and I'll like do some local community theater and be a mom, which was something else I always wanted to do, was be married and have a kid, you know, and be a mother. And so, and I was like, yeah, it'll be great. Because it was an easy deal to make, because I was very certain that like in 2 years, I mean, come on, like 6 months, I'm gonna be hitting it big. So we're gonna have no problem. And he was like, yeah, and if in that same 2 years, you become successful, I'll move to LA and we'll have our life there. So this was the agreement. So 2 years comes along and nothing. There's literally no indication that this is going to work out. And he's like, so.
Oh, so he followed through.
Yeah,
he's in Detroit.
We stayed together and he's wow. I'm graduating. What do you say? And I said, I'm not leaving. And he's like, I'm not coming. And I was like, it was very cordial. And it was like, and in that moment I knew like, I'm never going to stop doing this. Like, this is who I am, and I'm not going to put a time limit on it anymore. And I actually had a lot less anxiety after that, because that two-year mark, that was like a big, like, that was very, is anxiety producing,
yeah.
You know, because I'm like, in order to keep the boy, I had to succeed in 2 years, you know. But I realized, well, I can't ask you to give up your dream. You want to go move back to your hometown and serve your community and be with those people, and your mom wants to be close to her grandkids and all these things, you know. That's the life you've always envisioned for yourself, and you wouldn't feel good living in LA not knowing anybody and my haphazard life with the dildo and the crazy patches of fur and, you know, that insanity.
He dodged a bullet.
He dodged a real bullet. Yeah. And me too.
Yeah.
Me too, because I would have been miserable. I would have been miserable. I wouldn't have been happy.
Imagine him, though, like when The Office premieres. He's like, I should have made my commitment 8 years.
8 years. If in 8 years you've made it,
that's
we'll
right.
stay together. No, I'm sure he's not sad.
Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Let me tell you about this week's sponsor, Quip. If you listen to the intro, you know I like me some beef jerky. And after I enjoy that beef jerky, there's nothing I like more than brushing my teeth. And when it comes to your health, brushing your teeth is one of the most important parts of your day. Quip knows that. They've combined dentistry and design to make a better electric toothbrush. I've been using electric toothbrushes for many years and I love them. And Quip is the new electric toothbrush that packs just the right amount of vibrations into a slimmer design at a fraction of the cost of the bulkier traditional electric brushes. And the guiding pulses alert you when to switch sides, making brushing the right amount of effortless. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel anywhere, whether it's going in your gym bag or carry-on. And that's great for me because I usually travel with a traditional toothbrush, and now I have an electric toothbrush that I can take with me. And because the thing that cleans your mouth should also be clean, Quip's subscription plan refreshes your brush on a dentist-recommended schedule, delivering new brush heads every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. That's a pretty good deal, because if you're like me, you probably don't change your toothbrush head every 3 months. And now, with Quip, I do. Quip is backed by a network of over 10,000 dental professionals, including dentists, hygienists, and dental students. Most toothbrushes don't get named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of the year, but Quip did, so find out for yourself why. Quip starts at just $25 And if you go to getquip.com/offcamera right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/offcamera. That's spelled getquip.com/offcamera. So folks, this is a no-brainer. This is a great toothbrush, and I use it, and I fully support this company. So do yourself a favor, check them out, and let me know if you like it. All right, now back to the show.
Most stories, when you look at actors, there's some place where they got some sort of lucky break where they get to jump some steps.
Yeah.
With you, I noticed you pretty much hit every step. You hit the industrial films and the PSAs and the extra work. And one thing that really stuck out to me about your history is that you were on the movie Pleasantville as an extra.
I was.
And reading that, I'm thinking, okay, in the book, it almost sounds like a triumph because it represented, I think, a time when you got SAG eligibility.
I got my vouchers.
You got your vouchers
for
SAG.
I got to be in SAG.
But I also wondered if sitting there in that restaurant scene, and there's Tobey Maguire and Reese Witherspoon, and they're acting, and you are, what, 5-10 feet away from them?
Yeah.
I wonder if watching that made you feel closer to your dream or further away.
Yes. I think both.
Yeah.
Because it's like, well, at least I'm here. Like,
right.
At least I'm, you know, I'm not still in St. Louis. I'm in L.A., and I'm not just in L.A. I'm on a working film set today. So, like, I'm in the game, kind of. But, yes, the there's still so much real estate between me as the extra and me as a lead role in this film.
Yeah.
And, it's funny because I think it's true, and I never really even realized. Like, I don't think I did skip a step. And I have friends who skip steps, and yet what I found was that it didn't necessarily make the journey, their journey didn't end up being then effortlessly easier.
Right.
My friend Sean Gunn got like a small speaking role in Gilmore Girls, which then turned into a recurring role, which then turned into a regular role. It's like, it's every actor's dream.
As that was occurring, you were watching it.
Yeah,
did
I'm
it
watching
it.
And,
like,
and he came out to LA, and he was like within 6 months, he's working all the time. And then this Gilmore Girls thing happened.
What does that do to the voice in your head?
It's like, what? And a lot of my friends were like that. Like, it was either that or they left after 2 years. Like, that 2-year mark seemed to be where most people were like, I'm done.
Right.
Like, I'm out of here. And then I'm in this weird middle ground. So I was like neither successful nor not successful. I was like kind of like, maybe I'm doing okay.
You were in limbo.
But I was in limbo. And that's a hard thing to quit.
In the book, you talk about being a very nervous, self-judgmental person by nature. And you almost say that this is almost a common trait of actors. But in terms of perseverance, you talk about being in auditions where you describe literally you could feel your teeth throbbing because you were so nervous.
Throbbing in my mouth, yeah.
So I can't shake this idea of when all these physical things are happening.
Yeah.
And all this inactivity is happening and you're in that place of limbo. What keeps you going?
I have the delusion. I think the delusion kept me going. I don't know what kept me going. That's such an interesting thing. I had a friend from college who he said to me once, he was like, Jenna, you are the most focused person I've ever met. Like, you say you're going to do something and you do it. And I don't know how you do it because, like, sometimes the things you say sound like impossible. Like, how could you possibly do that thing?
Right.
And then I did start to look back over my life and I realized, like, yeah, like I kind of do. Like, even if it takes a really long time, what is that trait? Am I delusional?
Well, apparently not.
Why do, but I,
because you're
I'm
here
like,
and you've had this amazing career. You
no,
weren't
but I,
delusional.
But I think I'm that person who, like, you know, like you hear a story about like someone who wants to change something and they're like, I'm going to go sit on the steps of the Capitol for as long as it takes. And they sit there for like 17 years later. The lawmaker meets with them and a deal is made. Like, because I hear a story like that and then I'm like, oh, so it's just pure grit and willpower. Like, I will wait you out until you agree with me that I'm a working actor. I'll wait it out with you. let's keep waiting. And by the way, that I think that's part of the magical thinking of my mom, which is like, you've been to those ball games where it's like 10 to 0, and then in the end, the other team wins 11 to 10. It happens. It could happen to you.
Is that weird?
It's like if you just don't leave, the right guy is going to come to the party. Like, you will fall in love and all the things will happen. I don't know. I think it's some of that.
You tell this story in the book that is worth mentioning, I think, because it's almost like, you know, in a film, you wouldn't believe it. It would be a character invented to sort of set, you know, your lead character on the right path. You know?
Yes. Yeah. I was working as a typist, a transcriber at the Television Critics Association event, which happens every year in L.A., where television shows come and present their new show or their new lineup, the networks.
So again, you're this close.
I'm
to
so
where
close,
you
right?
Be,
I know.
But you're just a typist.
I'm just a typist. Over here. I'm in the typing room and I'm transcribing the celebrities and the showrunners as they talk about their new shows.
Right.
And if we got our work finished in time, we were allowed to go to these parties at night. And one of the parties was going to be a special party for just the Saturday Night Live cast and the press. And I really wanted to go to that party, but it was at 5 o'clock and we were never done with our work that early. And so I pretended to be sick for like 2 days. I mean, like, I really was like, I had to go to this party. I don't know why, but I just had to go. I think it was that thing where it's like, I just want to be in a room with these people that I want to be like. And maybe that'll make me feel like something. So I did. I pretended to be sick. But see, I got paid by the hour. So, you know, I had to work until 4 and then be sick.
The sickness had to gradually come on.
I couldn't be so sick that they didn't let me come in for the whole day. I had to gradually get sick all day.
This may have been your best performance to date.
It probably is my best performance. And so then I went out. I had this party dress in my car. I went out to my car. I put on the party dress.
It's such an LA story.
It's insane. I finagled my way back inside, and then I got into the SNL party, and there, I'll never forget, like, Norm MacDonald, like, eating, and because Norm MacDonald kind of looks like my dad, and, like, eating food off the buffet, and I was like, okay, I'm too nervous to say something to Norm MacDonald. I can't say anything to Norm MacDonald. And then just all these different people that I admired, and then I saw Molly Shannon. And so I kind of inserted myself into her little press circle, and I didn't know what it was. Like, I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know they were press. So I thought we were just all having a conversation, and we're all party goers. So then I'm, like, saying dumb stuff, and people are giving me stink eye. And so eventually they left, and I kind of had her to myself, and I just said, hey, I just want you to know I admire you so much, and I'm new in town. I've been here about a year, and it's hard, and I just didn't know if you had any advice. Oh, my God. And she turned to me, and she put her hands on my shoulders and, like, looked deep into my eyes, and she was like, yes, my advice is don't give up, okay? You can't give up. She said, it took me 10 years before I landed on SNL. For 10 years, I walked around New York, and no one knew who I was. And then Saturday Night Live happened and everything changed. So you just can't give up. Okay, good luck. And then she, like, walked away. But, like, to have Molly Shannon, like, I'm thinking to myself, Molly Shannon. It took Molly Shannon 10 years to get noticed. Like, it shouldn't take Molly Shannon 10 years to get noticed. And I just held on to that. And I went home and I cried and I called my mom. And then whenever I would say I was going to quit, my mom would be like, Molly Shannon said it took her 10 years, baby. Like, me and my mom were like, Molly Shannon said 10 years.
And your dad's like, as long as it doesn't cost me anything.
Yeah, exactly. Just don't ask for any money. Exactly. So, it was like, I don't know. It was like this new, very far away goal of 10 years, like, that it can take this idea that, like, even if you're good enough, it takes a really long time to get to a place where anyone notices that you exist. And it kept me going, like, in a big way. But I guess the book is trying to, like, let people know, like, I know you feel here and everybody seems here, but, like, no one was, like, just came out here. Like, there's, like, 4 people who, like, started here. But most people, like, they had to, and maybe sometimes it was like they jumped and then they went down and then they came up. But do you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
It's okay that you feel like you don't know what you're doing, or like your success and then fail and then all those. That's all normal. I just did that movie with Mike White and Ben Stiller.
Brad Status, yeah.
Yes. I think that Mike White is a genius. So I saw Enlightened, but I had seen everything. I had seen Chuck and Buck. I had seen Year of the Dog. I see Enlightened. I call my manager and I say, I need to meet Mike White. I need to meet him. Like, I want to meet him. So I go into the meeting and I'm terrified. And
now, what are you terrified of?
Because you're like, who am I to be here? Like, he's not going to want to work with me. Like, I don't know. Just like, what are we meeting? It was a general meeting. It was just like, I said I wanted to meet him, and now I'm in the room. What do I do? And his producing partner is there, and I get in the room. I mean, he was also on Amazing Race with his dad.
I know.
So I'm asking him about Amazing Race. And then I was married by Jeff Probst. Jeff Probst officiated my wedding to my now husband, Lee Kirk. And he was a big Survivor fan. So I was like, this is the most Hollywood story now. I'm realizing this is like so Hollywood. I'm so glad that I have an entire book full of all of my very non-Hollywood events that you can read to understand that this is not really my life. Okay, as I'm saying it, I'm like, I can't believe all these things are true. And I was like, Mike, he loved Survivor, like loved Survivor. And I was like, let's go to dinner. I'll say, I know Jeff is a fan of yours. Let's all go to dinner. So then we all go to dinner and we have this amazing dinner. Again, this happens to me like never. And then I started to become kind of friends with Mike. But for a long time, every time I was talking to him, I just kept thinking, I can't believe I'm talking to Mike White. Like, Mike White is a genius and he's talking to me.
Imposter syndrome.
Imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
Just socially, social imposter, which I have a lot because I have a lot of social anxiety in that way. And so then there was this time when I had just taken a job, and then Mike sent me an email saying, I'm going to do this project and I thought you might be right for it. Do you want to do it? And I couldn't do it because I just agreed to do something else. So then I was about to take a job in this Steve Martin play, and my agent sent me Brad Status.
I love that you just glossed over the fact that...
I did a Steve Martin play. That's so crazy.
As you're talking about how Mike White's a genius, and you can't believe you're talking to him.
Yes. And then, so I'm about to accept this role in this
play. Good thing this isn't a Hollywood story.
This is not a Hollywood. This is so not Hollywood. I mean, there's so many names falling on the floor. We need a broom. My God. I'm dropping them all over the place. So Barbara Streisand calls me. And I'm like, Babs. No, that did not happen. Like, what would you do? No, So anyway, I write Mike an email, and I'm like, Mike, I do not want to exploit our friendship, but I've read this movie, and it's amazing, and I want to play the wife in this movie. I don't know if you think I'm right for it, but I need to tell you how brilliant it is. Like, I need to work with you. And then I just put it out of my brain. I was like, okay, it's not going to happen. And then after the play was over, he called me on the phone, and he was like, you're about to get an offer to play the wife in this movie, and I'm so excited to work with you. And then the whole time I was working with him, I couldn't stand. I was so nervous. I was, and then Ben Stiller, who's a genius as well. I just had that imposter syndrome the whole time I was there. I had so much social anxiety, so much anxiety. It was coming out in the weirdest ways. Like, I just. Most of the acting I did on that film was me pretending like I wasn't losing my shit all the time inside. Like, but it was like two acting jobs at once, pretending like I believed I belonged there and then doing the acting job. And then going home, I socialized with no one because I was like, I can't take like a third role. I can't take the role of like my own self at dinner. I have to just, I'm gonna make an excuse and go home and just like watch CNN or something and go to bed. Eat room service. I couldn't.
Hearing you say that, it encapsulates sort of who you are in the sense that it seems incredibly relatable that if you admire someone's work that much and you can't believe you get to work with them and you do, that's a nervous type of situation. I understand that. But at the same time, you're writing Mike that email and you're persevering and you're being sort of assertive, and
yeah,
that's wrapped up in what you do too. But that idea also that you have been doing this for so long now. I mean, you are Pam Beasley on The Office and on a super successful, everyone knows the show for 9 years, and yet you still think that you're going to be kicked out of the room.
Listen, I just feel like Mike's work is like of a certain level, and I don't want to be the person who messes up the movie.
I think that is incredibly, probably encouraging to artists that are feeling that, who are nowhere near your success. You know what I mean?
But I mean, I'm not great at every role I do. Like, I feel like when I look over my career, I feel like I believe there are certain roles where I was legitimately the best person to play the part. Like, yes, that was mine. And I feel like Pam Beasley, that's mine. I own that. Like, I can't imagine, it had to be mine. Like, and I feel it in my bones. That was me. But there's other roles where I'm like, it could have been someone else and it would have been just as good. Like, I did an adequate job. Like, I did the part. But, like, could someone else have played the part? Uh-huh. As long as you're not thinking, oh, my God, she was horrible, then I did a great job.
Your humility is endearing.
It's true.
But there's a self-deprecation level here that it does not match your success. So I just want to tell you that.
Well, thank you.
I think you're going to be okay. But you know, hearing that, though, that idea of being on a set, being at a dinner, being in the presence of someone whose work you admire so much and still feeling that, I think that's maybe a feeling that never goes away, no matter how successful you get.
I think that's true. And then there's like, it's always surprising to me who I get nervous around too.
Right.
I had a director tell me once, he was like, because I was sort of confiding about these nerves I have. And he was like, you know, everybody's insecure, right? And he was like, everybody's just thinking about their side of the conversation when they go home. Like, no one's thinking about your side of the conversation, just you.
Right.
And I was like, right, maybe that's true.
What is it about a Hollywood film set or this business in particular that makes it so intense?
But isn't everybody always almost losing their job? You know, like, you are just like one horrible performance away from not getting the next job.
Right.
So those stakes are real. They're kind of always there. And so
there's enough there for you to justify your insecurity. Well, this really fortuitous for the reader, but not so fortuitous for you, occurrence happens in the book, where right in the middle of writing it, you get fired.
Yeah, from a high-profile job.
Right. Was it with Matt LeBlanc?
Yes, it was a Matt LeBlanc three-camera sitcom, which is still on the air right now with a person who's not me.
Man with a Plan.
Man
right?
with a Plan. And I was in the pilot of that. Not
on
the
show. You were part of the plan.
As I was originally part of the plan, not so much now.
So you're in the middle of writing this book about, hey, here's all the...
Yeah, here's all my
here's
advice.
Here's how you do it,
right. Everybody.
And you get fired for the first time in your life.
Which was weird because my publisher was like, Jenna, you know, do you want to talk a little bit about what it's like to get fired from a job? Because I hear that's very common and it would probably make people feel good. And I was like, I'd love to, but I've actually never been fired. And so when it happened, I called him. I was like, are you happy, Glenn? Are you happy? I've been fired.
Gonna
write about it now.
What if Glenn made a
Did
call?
Did Glenn make a call? He's like, the book would be much better if there was a big turn right here where like something big happened.
Hey, Matt, how would you like a 2-year book deal?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, so, okay. So typical thing that happens, the pilot gets shot.
Yes.
And then they do network testing.
I'm assuming they focus groups, all that jazz.
Right.
Yeah. And I guess I did not fare well in the focus groups. Like, more than one person said, I don't believe Pam would marry Joey. Like,
right.
And I was like, okay.
Joey from Friends and Pam from The Office.
Yeah, they're not a couple. We're not seeing, we don't believe it.
So here you have this book that you've written where throughout it, you're talking about how important it is to know yourself mm-hmm. and to know what kind of character you are. And you find this ultimate job as Pam Beasley for 9 seasons on The Office.
Yeah.
And then that ends up being a double-edged sword when all of a sudden there are focus groups going, we can't see her as
this other
something
character.
Else. I mean, did that sort of make you step back a little bit?
It's interesting. I remember thinking, like, me and Matt LeBlanc, like, as a married couple, like, I had that same thought. I'm like, Joey? Like, and me? But the script was really funny, and it's a 3-camera show, and it was 10 minutes from my house, and I'd be home for dinner every night. Right. I was like...
The priorities have shifted.
Yeah, correct. Like, the filter by which jobs seem super appealing is different than in my 20s. So, you know, where in my 20s, I'm like, Costa Rica for 4 months? Yeah.
Awesome.
Great. Sign me up. And it pays $17? I'm in.
Right.
So, but yeah, so I went in for the chemistry read, and we had a wonderful comedic chemistry. Like, it was like he was very warm and friendly and fun and all that. And then they offered me the job. So I did it, and like, we did the pilot. We did like a read through of the pilot for the network, and the note was more Jenna, more scenes with Jenna and Matt. So then I get extra scenes, and I'm like, I'm killing it. Like, I'm doing so good. We shoot the pilot, and as we're shooting it, I'm noticing, like, I feel like people are like, you know.
Because you can feel that.
You can feel like, what is it? What? You know? But no indication. And then the focus groups happen, and then I get this phone call. And it was funny because in the days before it was supposed to get picked up, because everyone was like, it's getting picked up. It's Matt LeBlanc. It's James Burrows. It's CBS. Like, right. It's happening. And so I'm like planning my dress for the upfronts, for the big announcement in New York. And then 2 days later, I get this phone call where they're like, every agent is on the phone. Like, suddenly, that's one of the things, like, when you get to a certain level, you have like 40 agents. I don't know where all these agents come from. Now they're all on the phone. Some of them I've never met. They're all on the phone. And you're like, this isn't good. They only call you, all 40 agents only call you when, like, Steven Spielberg's offering you a role in a movie or you've been fired. Just, you know.
Right.
You know, and like, hello? Okay, that was a lot of introductions. What's up?
Yeah.
And I said, it's bad news, isn't it? And they said, yeah. And I said, we didn't get picked up. And they were like, no, it's worse. The show got picked up, but it's going to be moving forward without you. And I was like, I got fired? They're like, you've been fired. And I was like, oh, wow. Wow. Interesting. I've been fired. I am dealing with this now. Okay. And then, you know, what was really hard about that, and I didn't put this in the book because it just didn't seem like totally like applicable, was there were all these tabloid stories then about like that Matt and I didn't get along or that we were fighting or that like, and it started to give me a complex because I literally started to be like, am I delusional? I know I'm a little delusional, but I'm like, I'm not that, like, we weren't fighting. We talked about things. Like, we had a totally pleasant experience.
Did you have that fear that everyone knows something that you don't?
Yes. Where I was like, what's happening? Like, this alternate reality story was being told.
Does everyone know my career is over but me?
Yeah, all of it. Everything. Yeah. I was like, what is going on? Like, you know, I'm like, and they're saying it's focus groups, but I'm like, did I actually suck? And so those were my questions. Like, give it to me straight. And then they were like, no, we'll send it to you. You can watch it. And, you know, I watched it and I was like, oh, I thought I was like charming and cute and it was great. But I think I saw what the focus group saw, which was, yeah, we didn't seem like a couple. We kind of seemed like two people doing good performances, and they were both quite good shows, but they weren't the same show.
So often, and this seems to apply to auditioning, it seems to apply to almost every aspect of what you do, is that it's so often not about your core performance.
Right. It's not that you didn't get the job because you were bad.
It's because of...
You weren't a match for whatever that thing
right.
is.
And chemistry is such a strange thing, because obviously the chemistry you had with John Krasinski in The Office was the reason that that show made it into, like, the homes and minds and hearts of everybody, and the reason that show went 9 seasons.
How lucky am I that somebody called him into audition? Like, and that we... Do you know what I'm saying? Like, thank God.
But it brings up a question of what is chemistry? Because if Hollywood executives or writers or directors could figure that out in advance, but you can't. Is it the most elusive thing about what you do?
It is. And I think a lot of times people think chemistry is you're in love with that person in real life and you would date or marry or have sex. Like that.
And
that,
we're seeing that happen.
Yeah, right. That's what chemistry is.
Us to us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But for me, chemistry is when you have to work the least to be most authentic as your character. So when I met John and I worked with John, I didn't have to try at all. Like, I remember there's this place physically where once I get into this spot, like so many inches away from John's like shoulder, like this part of his shoulder, I'm just Pam. Like, it just is, like, it just happens like magic. Like, that's the magical thing about chemistry, is that, like, now I'm Pam. And that is what was so amazing about working with him, was that we didn't have to try. We could just be our characters. But that happens, like, I remember that happened with Rashida. Like, they did chemistry reads with me and some Karens. And Rashida came in and sat across from me. And I was like, oh, I'm Pam with Karen. Gosh. We just were it.
What you're saying is that...
it's amazing.
You, like, how much you can be yourself is dependent on who you're with.
I think it is, yeah. And then, you know, since that's not always there, a good actor has to figure out how to cheat, how to make you believe that the chemistry is there when it's not there. But when it is there, it opens up this whole other world of possibilities for those characters and for those performances, because that part of the work is done for you. And it's an amazing thing when you find it and you feel so lucky. But there's a lot of jobs where, you know, you have to manufacture it, which is, you know, part of the job, and
sure,
it's fine. And there's no number of, like, dinners you can go on with a person that suddenly creates chemistry. You know,
right,
like, sometimes you do that. You're like, okay, we're going to play husband and wife in this movie or show. Let's go out to dinner and chat and get to know each other. So there's a familiarity. That can create a familiarity and a comfort level with the other person that helps you be vulnerable around them. But I don't think it necessarily produces that same, like, chemistry.
Well, you know, I think that it's an interesting way how those two things dovetail, that you sort of got to see the fallout from chemistry not happening, but also by looking at that situation and getting the pilot from your agents, you sort of got to also see that you've been in this business long enough to go, oh, it wasn't me. But
yeah,
I'm assuming even at the place you were, it probably knocked your confidence down a little bit.
It did. I mean, because, you know, I had purposely not been working a lot since the birth of my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
My son was born while I was doing The Office, and I had to juggle that while doing the final seasons. And so I gave myself that space. Like, I wanted that.
Right.
And then, like, I let another kind of pilot season go by, and then I was finally like, I'll jump in. And then this show came along, and I was like, again, this is going to fit into my, like, fantasy parenting.
Right.
Scenario.
You got a little too comfortable.
I got a little too comfortable. And then I got fired. And so I'm thinking, oh, wow. So people haven't seen me for a while. And then the next thing that happens is that I get fired. Are they going to think that the reason they haven't seen me is because I couldn't get hired and then I got fired? Is that what they're going to think? Do I need to do, like, a press conference where I announce that this sabbatical was self-imposed?
Right.
Like, no, people were calling.
We need to clear
people
things up.
People were calling. I was saying no. Does anyone believe me? You know what I mean? Like, so that, all of that, like, creeps in, and then you, I don't know, I just had to be, like...
Well, at least the delusion works both ways.
The delusion works both ways. I had to just be, like, I had to be secure, or try to be secure in knowing, like, I know the truth.
Right. Well,
I know the truth, and I can't control what other people think. But at the same time, you're like, but if just I know the truth, it's not enough if I'm depending on other people to hire me and they think a truth is something else. So, and that's when the Steve Martin thing came up. That was right after I got fired. Steve Martin reached out and asked me to do, to be in the world premiere of his play Meteor Shower. But it was like the creative thing that I needed to, like, feed me and like nurse me back from that, like the trauma of being let go, of
right,
being fired. And then right after that, I get the email from Mike White. And then you're like, if I was on Man with a Plan right now, I wouldn't have spent a summer working with Steve Martin. I couldn't have been in Brad's status.
Right.
Like, at the time, everyone's telling you, like, oh, don't worry, better things are on the horizon. You're like, fuck off. Like,
yeah.
I hate you for saying that. Like,
and you don't believe them.
You don't believe them. You're like, no one's ever going to hire me again. You know, that's what I'm thinking. And so then, like, but then it did end up being true. So that was good.
What I hear you saying is there's a fundamental truth to this business, that it's out of your control.
That's true.
And that's the only thing you can control is your relationship with uncertainty.
Yes. And you can control your readiness. You can control your level of technique, your level of professionalism. You can control, like, your ability to be ready for work, but you can't control whether anyone's going to want you to work.
Well, I think that it really put some poignancy on the last half of the book, because to sort of go through that, you know, as you're writing the book, and to see that there's still a very human, visceral reaction to that that can knock your confidence down. That is sort of the life of the artist, that you have to be willing to go through the ebbs and the flows of the whole thing. And I want to end on, there's a picture in the book of you and your dog and your sister and your parents. And you say that this picture was taken, I think the car was already packed.
It was.
Was the cat already in the hatchback?
The cat might have been in the hatchback, because it was a picture that was taken just as I was about to get in my car. And
right, and it's the last time your family was probably intact in that small...
You're going to make me cry.
Well, but in a way, the person in that photo doesn't exist anymore. And I don't know, I wonder if writing this book gave you a larger sense of the entire picture than you would have had if you didn't do it.
Yeah, I think it did, because now it's all down. It's all in one story.
Right.
And that moment that you're talking about of me leaving my parents, that's also the last time that they were really the experts. That was the last time that, because like they could help me get ready to leave, tell me what to pack, teach me how to balance a checkbook, teach me about credit card debt. You know, like they could make sure, my dad could make sure there was gas in the car.
And cat litter.
And cat litter. There was a litter box in the backseat.
Oh,
and, you know, all that sort of stuff, like plan the route for me.
Right,
you know,
right.
This is before cell phones, you know, I had a map. And so they could do all that for me. And then they had to let me go. And then when I was in L.A., like, they couldn't really be the experts anymore. Like, you know, like you can't call them and say, what do I do at this callback?
But that's the biggest gift they could have given you,
and
is
it's
you're
crazy.
On your own.
Yeah.
Right?
But it is crazy. Like that is like, that was, I left that. And then, because if I had stayed in St. Louis and continued on a more conventional path, they would still be the experts of a conventional path. They would still be able to kind of be like, now here's how you go into a job interview. But that's a big part of, I think, growing up in a traditional or more conventional life and then going to an artistic life that is different. Like the modeling is...
You have to figure it out.
Totally figure it out. And I think one thing that you said, which is accurate, which was like... you know, I remember, and I'm very touched by this, is that my father, I'm going to cry. I know that my father gave up a lot of work opportunities that might have been like higher paying or just with more razzle dazzle titles, you know, certain achievements that would be very ego boosting and very exciting, so that my family could live in St. Louis our whole lives. And he was always very happy in his job. He was never a miserable person. Like, he always loved what he did. But creating that life for us was really important to him, and it superseded his own ambition. And that actually, that value is something that I have, that I know what that felt like as a kid to have that. And so even though we're two artists raising kids, I'm willing to sacrifice my own ambition for their stability. And because it's their turn now, in a way, right? Like now it's kind of their turn. And their turn starts now. It doesn't start when I put them in the car. Like their turn starts now. And
right.
So I did have modeling for that, I guess.
Well, I think inadvertently you may have given them the greatest gift of all, which is you wrote this book that on the surface may be about, you know, how to be an actor, but I think it goes much deeper than that, and it's how to live a life and persevere and follow a dream. And I think that it's such an amazing document to leave behind for your kids and to sort of express that you know, you can create your own path and figure it out. And
thank you.
It's Thanks. Amazing to hear these stories from you. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Hey folks, that's our show. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did, and I appreciate you listening. And if you happen to be a starving or struggling artist, I recommend you read Jenna's book, The Actor's Life, immediately. And even if you aren't starving, it's a real inside baseball look at the film and television industry. Also, you can see Jenna in her new TV comedy series, Splitting Up Together. Or just go watch old episodes of The Office. You know you want to. And hey, if you were an off-camera monthly subscriber, you could also go watch John Krasinski's off-camera episode. It was our second one ever, and it's available to watch right now on the device of your choosing. That's right, for $4.99 a month, you can have unlimited access to our entire archive. That's 130 shows and counting. So check out the TV version of off-camera and go deep into the stories that shaped your favorite actors, directors, musicians, and artists. I also want to take the time to thank everybody that works on this show. And if you listen to us regularly, some of these names have probably become familiar to you. But I also want to introduce you to a new person on our off-camera team. This week, we welcome Sasha Snow, who is going to run our office and hopefully clean up the books, or at least dust the books. I don't know. We'll see. But we want to welcome her heartily. And I also want to thank Crawford Shippey, our producer, Nathan Shields, who handles editing and sound, Michaela KK Galvin, our graphic designer, Amy Jones, our wordsmith, Kara Johnson, our transcriber, and Matt Davidson, assistant to the Chief Custodial Services Director. And mostly, I want to thank you, the listener, because without you, we wouldn't have a show. And without a show, I wouldn't get to learn all these amazing things about the artists that I admire. So thank you for supporting Off Camera. And please, if you haven't yet, take a minute, go to offcamera.com and show your support by either getting a monthly subscription to our TV show, or buying a magazine, or maybe even just by simply writing me a letter and telling me who you'd like to see on the show. I'm Sam at offcamera.com. You can also find us by searching Off Camera Show on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, or my personal Instagram, Sam Jones Pictures, and my personal Twitter, Sam Jones. So check all that out, and be sure to join me next time when I sit down with Danai Gurira.
In college, I was definitely engaged in theater, but it wasn't what I thought I was going to do. Once I went to South Africa for study abroad, not long after apartheid ended, I wanted to go to their Durban program, which was all about political stuff. And they said, you have to do the Cape Town program, which is arts and social change. I'm like, oh. And so I go and do this, and then I get to meet all these amazing artists who would use their art to change the landscape of how the world could no longer ignore what was happening in South Africa. Then I realized your passion, Danai, is obviously in the arts.
You surely know Danai from The Walking Dead and Black Panther. But when you listen to this episode, you will realize how much more there is to know about this Zimbabwean-American actor, playwright, director, and storyteller. Join me for a conversation that crosses borders, mixes mediums, and even reveals the secret behind how Michelangelo created his David. See you next time, off camera.